Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is George Pelicanos, author of the short story collection Owning Up. Author Dennis Lehane describes Owning Up as four blistering novellas, drawn together by themes of strife, violence, and humanity. George Pelicanos is the best-selling author of 22 novels and story collections set in and around Washington, D.C. He is also a producer and Emmy-nominated writer of HBO's The Wire, Tremé, The Deuce, and We Own This City. He lives in Maryland. We had technical difficulties with the recording that excluded the first few minutes of the interview. So we pick it up with a discussion about how the two main protagonists of the first story in the collection, Ira, who was white, and Gerard, who was black, met in a Washington, D.C. jail. Pelicanos talks about the disparate treatment of whites and blacks for white-collar crimes by judges.
Because judges will tend not to send a white person, especially a white-collar criminal, white criminal, into the system. And now it's different now because of the January Sixers. There's a bunch of them down there. But before that, there weren't any, pretty much. And that was just enough to spark a... and then the guy that he befriends is also not a violent criminal. In fact, he got caught up in something. He was riding with somebody who had a gun in the car with shaved numbers, and he wasn't even aware that there was a gun in the car. But they've locked him up pending trial. So that's how they meet.
So this character, Gerard Williams, which you, I guess, he's a minor supporting character, but he's also sort of like the moral center. Yes. of the short story, The Amusement Machine. Talk about centering him, even though he's not the protagonist.
I mean, I think if I look back at my work, there's always somebody like that in my books who is not really the protagonist or the nominal protagonist, but is the moral center, is the hero, if you will, of the book. And the reason that he is or she is because they go to work every day. They sort of ignore all the noise around them and they just keep focused and they go to work. This book, Shoe Dog, I wrote 25 years ago. The shoe dog is a shoe salesman, a guy named Randolph. If you're reading the book, you think Constantine is the guy, but he's also a screw up. And at the end, Randolph is still standing. He's still selling shoes. It's the same thing with Gerard. And then Gerard comes back at the end of the story to talk to the book group because he's starting to make a success of himself as a character actor. And again, he's never going to be a movie star or anything like that, but he's sort of fulfilling his ambition and his dream through hard work. And one of the, actually it's Iris says to him, "Can you talk about this to us about why you do it?" And there's this kind of monologue he gives about why he's an artist and why it's important. And it's the point of the story. It's why you go to work every day, why we do what we do as writers. You know, I'm aware of my mortality. I'm getting closer to it. Why do I keep writing, you know? And it all comes down to having your name on the spine of a book. It'll be in the Library of Congress, hopefully still in a couple hundred years. Somebody will see that I was here, that I existed. It's as simple as that.
I want to jump to the last story in your collection, Owning Up, and the character of Ed. So the protagonist in this story, Nikos, we start off with him at 13. A lot of the action comes around the age of 18. He's working at this appliance store that has a diverse group of people working there. We have a racist, we have the Jewish owner, we have the black character, Ed, and we have Nikos, who's an 18-year-old, just trying to figure out how to get ahead, comes from a middle-class family, and susceptible to the older guy, I believe his name is Ray, don't have his name in front of me, but susceptible to older guy that works at the store.
But is Ed the, I would guess he's in his 30s, maybe 40s, the black young man that works at the store that kind of watches out for him. And he's vulnerable, doesn't know he's vulnerable. And I can think about how I felt at that age, at 18, and you wanted to get in a little bit of the action, and there's somebody you look up to that you just want to hang with them, even though you're not thinking about the consequences of hanging with that guy that could get you in trouble. But he had Ed. Talk about Ed.
Yeah, it's sort of a composite of guys I knew that were, I worked retail like that in the beginning, and they would take me aside and give me advice, but not in an overbearing way. It's just sort of quietly, you know, what do you want to do that for? Or, you know, if I came into work and I was bragging about something I did with a young lady the night before, the guy might say to me, well, did you send her a note? Did you send her flowers? Like, no, I didn't. I didn't think of that. You know, it's little stuff like that where they kind of take you under their wing. And yet he was not as charismatic as the guy that Nikos was really under the spell of. And so he doesn't really realize it at the time. It's only looking back on it later in life that he says, I should have reached out. I should have reached out to that guy who was really looking out for me. And of course, when you move on in life, you never see those people again for the most part, but they stay in your memory.
I was curious about how you put this collection together. There's only four stories in this collection, but they're very long stories. And in some instances, while they focus on a certain period in the life of the protagonist, they tend to take a look back at the life of a couple of the protagonists. And so I was curious about whether these were stories that you wrote specifically for this collection, or were these stories you were working on, or some mixture of the two, where you said, I think I want to put these four stories together as a collection.
Yeah, it was a mixture. The one of the stories, Knickerbocker, was actually, I started as a novel about 12 years ago, and I did a tremendous amount of research because it was in the years that I didn't know anything about or experience, 1919 to 1923, and I interviewed my mom when she was still alive, and I had a lot of notes from her. Notes. I opened up the file last year, and there were her notes and her handwriting, and I thought I should get back to this. I knew I had already written a chapter back in the day, and I didn't. It's not that I didn't like it. I thought it was pretty tight, but I knew I couldn't sustain it over the course of a long novel. I couldn't sustain the dialogue and everything that I didn't have the confidence to write about a period that I didn't live in. So, but I did find a way in, which was to have a young writer who's trying to write a book in the 80s, and she seeks out these people who lived through that era, who experienced these historical events, and she interviews them. It's like an oral history kind of thing. And then the story gets told like that. That was my way of figuring that out. The other ones, I just, the no knock, which I'm sure we'll talk about, was something that happened to my family. And that's something that I waited 15 years to write, but it came very easily. And the other two were just, I just sat down and wrote them. I used the historical framework of the Hanafi Muslim siege and the murders in the Hanafi house on 16th Street to give me an engine. And then the one that we already talked about, the amusement machine, I just sat down and wrote that one. That was all no outline, just getting down every day and writing, you know, which is how I do it.
I was curious about using history and journalism. And I looked at these stories, especially when you talk about the Knickerbocker and what happened at the theater there, the tragedy of the roof caving in, the Hanafis. And I actually recall that period because you and I are around the same age. And I remember when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar bought that house in Washington, D.C. And I remember, you know, those things that happened. I was about 13 years old, and then about 17 with the second incident in 1977. And so I saw this engine of history, and then I sort of interpreted it as sort of this journalistic viewpoint. And I always often wonder, how do you see sort of the difference between history and journalism and how you use it in your stories?
Well, I think it's actually, I'm real interested in myth versus fact and how the myth develops and so on. And even journalism, as we know, isn't the exact truth. I mean, everything is written now, and especially now with a bit of a bias, even on the left. I mean, when I read the Washington Post now every day, stories are written in a different way than they would have been back in the 60s, let's say during Nixon's reign, even though most of the journalists were against Nixon, there was a much more objective presentation of his actions while in office, just the words that were chosen, versus today when people are writing about Trump, let's say. I mean, I think people are a lot angrier now, basically. And that kind of objectivity has sort of slipped away, but you could say for good reason, you know, but it's a guy trying to find out the truth. Or in the case of Knickerbocker, it's a woman trying to find out the truth. And of course, who she talks to, it has a different truth, or a different perspective. And that's how the story gets built.
Well, there's a part in this story where Robert Charles is a dishwasher at her father's restaurant.
Yes.
Or her grandfather's restaurant. Do I have that right?
Her father's.
Her father's restaurant. So she's interviewing her grandmother, going back to the 1920, and Robert Charles is a dishwasher at her grandmother's father's restaurant. So I guess that would be her great grandmother. And there's just a point in the story where he tells her, as she starts getting his backstory, right, and finding out his truth, his perspective. And 1919, we had some riots. There were race riots, with African-Americans coming home from World War I, not being respected for serving the country and fighting in the war. And there were some race riots going on. I believe they had some race riots in Washington, D.C. Well, this waiter talks about, and I'm from New Orleans, and I didn't know this story, or I forgot about this story. The race riot of 1900, and this character of Robert Charles. Now, you were a producer, writer for Treme, which, yes, I'm very familiar with that part of the city. I spent some time in the Treme area. How did you learn about this Robert Charles story? And why don't you give our audience a little background on who Robert Charles is from 1900?
Actually, so my partner on Treme and other shows, David Simon, when we were down in Treme, and that was 10 years ago now, he told me about this Robert Charles, and he said we should write a movie about it. And so I got the book, and Carnival of Fury, it's called. And now there's a new book, I've got it right here, by Andrew Baker. It's called To Poison a Nation. So there's two pretty good books written about this guy. He was a free man, born a free man after the Civil War. Kind of drifted around. His parents were sharecroppers. He came to New Orleans, and nobody knows exactly what happened, but he got into an argument with, well, a police officer came by. He and his friend were sitting on a stoop, just minding their own business. And the usual conversation ensued. What are you doing here? You know what I mean? And they got into an argument, and Robert Charles shot this policeman. And then he went to his house, and he got another weapon, a rifle. And eventually he shot a couple of other people, and he went to this house. He was boarded up in this house for like I think 2 days, and 1,000 people were out there, and he definitely held them off, going room to room shooting. And I think he shot 5 police officers and many more. And then they set fire. They managed to set fire to the house. He came out with holding guns. He never gave up. They killed him. They stomped him. They dragged him through the streets and all that. And, but a legend grew out of it around him. And people still talk about this guy to his day, because he was a guy in an era where people were generally afraid to assert themselves. He was a guy who took no man's shit. You know what I mean? He fought back. And it connects to the story, because the 1919 race riots, you can't even really call it a race riot. It was a race war in Washington for 3 or 4 days, where people actually fought back. There was guns on the roof. There was veterans who had armed themselves. 27 people were killed on both sides, white and black. And it's an example of people who take violent action, who took violent action during the whole century of civil rights. And the gentleman who she speaks to, Robert Charles, explains to her that it's all on a continuum. You might think that these things don't matter, that the 1919 riots didn't matter and the 1968 riots didn't matter, but they did matter. They pushed things forward. I'm not advocating for violence. I'm talking about history. That's what happened. And it's important to know about these events. And by the way, I'm still trying to make a movie about Robert Charles. I think it's a fascinating story. Haven't gotten any traction yet, but working on it.
Well, maybe we could have Wendell Pierce star in that. So, but to get back to the point that Leah doesn't get it. So Robert Charles is proud to have the name, and she says, "I can't begin to understand it," said Leah. "It's hard for me to listen to that story and take anything positive away from it." And his response is, "You can't see it from our perspective." And I think sort of that, and I think maybe that's one of the challenges we face today, is we have these different points of view about the way the world is, what has happened, what needs to happen. And I was talking to a friend of mine, she's in her early 70s, and she was part of the movement, the Black student movement in Houston, and Black Power movement, ended up becoming a very successful entrepreneur with a couple of successful daughters. But she is so gracious in believing in the movement, but still wanting to understand why the other side believes what they believe. And I think one of the challenges we face today is, even if you disagree, that this grace of allowing people a point of view is so, so important, even if you disagree, even if you're going to vote against it, you're going to lobby against it, you're going to march against it. But just this graciousness that she provides when she talks about, you know, allowing people to have their point of view, even if she vehemently disagrees with.
Yeah, I mean, right now it's very difficult to talk to people. And I wish, you know, I wish that there was more that kind of discussion. But right now, even as you know, people are trying to erase history. So it's hard to, I mean, it's one of the reasons of the impetus for writing something like this is to talk about, to say that these things happened, they did happen. You can stop teaching it in school. You can take the books out of the libraries. Doesn't change the fact that it happened. And, you know, it's for people our age, it's especially disheartening because there was a time when we thought, I'm assuming you thought too, that things were getting a lot better. And if you look at some of my interviews from, I don't know, 10 years ago where I'm on NPR or whatever, and I said, look, you know, when my generation and the people who are older than me die out, things are really going to, that's when things are really going to change, because people younger than me and the very young people don't have that same poison in our veins that we were affected by. Okay. But then I looked at Charlottesville, and those were all guys in their 20s marching. You know what I mean? So it's
yeah,
not
I
just
mean,
all,
we thought, but then if you study history, like post Reconstruction. And so there seems to be sort of this cyclical thing with history. It doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it feels like, you know, even Arthur Schlesinger years ago talked about the 25-year cycles of history, cycles of American history, his book. But I remember I interviewed a Texas A&M sociologist who wrote a book about how blacks built America. And he talked about some surveying that had been done of college students. And up to that point, I was like, you, it's getting better. It's getting better. It'll be good. We're good. And then he revealed to me that the attitude of college students was as bad as it was, say, 40 years ago. And I was just sort of shocked at what he said he discovered through this survey of college students. And that's when I realized, and that might have been 7 or 8 years ago, that oh no, maybe not. So I do want to talk about the no knock, because that was a traumatic story. And that story really centers on how the cavalier attitude in the story of the police of with the no-knock warrant. I'm wanting to understand better the sort of no-knock warrant that we know of a young African-American lady that was killed because of that. Just a tragedy. And how the cavalier attitude in the story, but the lasting trauma, within the story, sort of brings out sort of this inhumanity of people taking violent actions without recognizing or caring. And I think the operative word in my mind, at least, is caring about the trauma this will cause for the characters in this story for the rest of their lives. So talk a little bit about the inspiration of that story and the trauma that these incidents, the trauma that they have that can last a lifetime from those incidents.
So 15 years ago, when my oldest son was 18, he committed a crime. And I'm very deliberately saying he committed a crime, not that he made a mistake, you know. And he was involved in his accomplices robbed a drug dealer, and he was downstairs looking out to make sure that everything was safe. He didn't have a gun, but one of them had a gun. And in Maryland, you know, when you're involved in a robbery and there's a gun involved, it's a felony and you're looking at a mandatory 5-year sentence. So when I look at the warrant, it states clearly in there that he didn't have the gun. However, they did the next morning, they did a no-knock warrant on my house, which is exactly as it's described in the first 10 pages of the story. Everything that's in those opening pages is exactly how it happened. I was looking out the window and reading the paper. I heard something in my driveway. I looked out the window and there was two black vans screaming into my driveway and all these guys getting out with automatic rifles and handguns and battering rams and so on. And I shouted to my wife to get the dogs out of the back of the house, because recently a SWAT team had killed two dogs locally over in near College Park. And that when they went to the wrong house, they killed the dogs. So she did that. And then I looked down, I put my hands up. I knew what was happening. I looked down on my chest and there are all these red dots bouncing around on my chest. They had all the laser sights aimed at me. They burst through the door. They burst through the downstairs door. They did thousands of dollars worth of damage. They put me face down on the floor and handcuffed me behind my, with flex cuffs behind my back. I looked into the room. They were holding guns on my 12-year-old daughter and my middle-aged wife. And then they got me up and they put us down at a table and they said, "Do you know what this is about?" I said, "Yeah, I assume it's about my son, my oldest son." Because my other son was out of town. And what else could it be about, right? Gave me the warrant. The guy, police officer who accompanied the SWAT team was in a suit, the plainclothes guy. He was abusive. He said stuff like, "That's a real pretty watch you got on your dresser. What is that, a Tag Heuer?" You know, all that kind of stuff. And then in the course of this raid, somebody stole my son's gold crucifix from his room, his baptism cross. At the end of it, I walked out to my living room where my library is, and one of the SWAT guys was looking at my books, and he said, "Maybe you'll write about this someday," and he left. And he left the house. And right then I knew that I would write about it. But it took a long time. I wanted there to be a happy ending, and there was. My son's, 33. He works in the film industry. He's a director. He's in the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, very respected in his field. And my family's okay, but a lot of families never recover from these things. And the point of it all is that point of me writing it is that it was unnecessary. You know, they could have just called my house and said, "Your son committed a crime. We're going to arrest him, have him there, or bring him into the station," whatever. It was completely unnecessary. The other thing is that a lot of people get killed in these raids, and not just Breonna Taylor, but many, many other people, including police officers. In the Stand Your Ground states, they've outlawed these no-knock raids because in those states, people can shoot a police officer coming into their house and just say, "I didn't realize he was a cop." And finally, they very rarely find what they're looking for. They very rarely find large amount of drugs or caches of weapons or anything like that. They don't work. These things don't work. And as you said, the event ripples out forever within the family. You never forget it. And you're never not impacted by it. So there it is.
How difficult was it to write that story?
Well, it wasn't difficult because, like I said, my son is fine. My family's fine. My wife and I are pretty strong. We never broke down about it when it happened. Our first thought was, how do we keep our son out of prison? That's what we were focused on. And for the first year after that, we were waiting for a trial. So the sword of Damocles was hanging over us. And, that was the toughest part, is not knowing if your kid's going to go to prison or not. And he got 5 years. He got convicted. He pleaded guilty to the felony, pled guilty. And he got 5 years probation. And then I took him down to New Orleans and put him on the crew on Treme. That was his first job in the industry. And he did fine.
Wow. In the story, though, the character drinks a lot.
Yeah, he can't handle it.
Right. So, of course, this was a personal experience you had. You and your wife were strong enough to deal with. But there are people who have a very, very difficult, as you portrayed in the story itself, the character never does recover from that. The father of the young man who was arrested really never does recover from that. Talk about that character decision.
I think for him, it was a masculinity thing. It was, I didn't protect my family. And it was the fact that he felt so helpless, and you know how people say you feel violated. I don't like using that word because I think probably only a woman can say that. It's not a rape. It's a house. and you can replace all these things. But he couldn't handle it, and he goes down a real dark road that has a tragic ending. But just think about the relatives of Breonna Taylor. There's nothing you can do for them. They can win all the lawsuits they want. The police that were involved in that can be convicted of things and all that, but she's still dead, and that never goes away.
Absolutely. Well, I spent a little time recently in Washington, D.C. My daughter lives in the district. And so I got to know a little bit about the city. And one of the things you really do, especially in the story Owning Up, is you give us sort of a little bit of a history of some of the retail establishments in the heart of D.C. That Nikos works at the appliance store there in the heart of DC. One or two of the characters have parents that own the diner. And I believe your father owned the diner.
Yeah, that story, Owning Up, the title story, is very autobiographical, just about in every way. That was my life as a teenager back then. It's really a guy that's looking back and taking stock of his life, and including, things like, so he ends up being a successful journalist who can write about all these things and exercise them. But there's things he regrets, and like the way he treated girls when he was, he has a girlfriend whose father is held captive at the B'nai B'rith, as many people were, by the Hanafi Muslims. And he goes off, instead of being with her, comforting her, he goes off and breaks in an apartment with all these ne'er-do-well guys that day. And so he's not a very thoughtful kid, as many boys weren't in that era, as far as girls went. And he even talks about all the times that he in the back of his car went with a girl where she said, not tonight. I told my parents I'd be home by 11 o'clock. And he says, well, I'll get you home by 11:30, or I promise you I'll get you home by midnight, that kind of thing. And it was his inability to know that the girl was saying no. When a girl says no, you don't push it, man. But being that age and in that era, you just didn't have those, you didn't have those guardrails, you know what I mean?
I know
So it's a
exactly
lot of,
what you mean.
yeah.
And I think one of the things I'm thinking about, as I was saying earlier, I had a breakfast with a friend of mine who was part of the movement. And one of the things I told her, and why one of the reasons why I appreciate your stories, is sometimes I think storytelling is so underappreciated by males who want the facts, and I'm talking about my peers who really don't go into literature and don't really see a lot of value in reading fictional stories. They want the facts, but there's sort of this emotional connection that you can get that you typically cannot get from just writing the plain facts. There's always this emotional element that the storytelling provides. And also, as you know, one of the things I was talking to her about is as people try to survive today's era of politics and conflict and all these things, there's still much to learn from the past. We're not saying that the way we did it in the past is the way to do it today, but there are still crucial lessons that I think everybody can get from reading stories about how it happened in the past. And I think you, as a storyteller, you sort of, in my mind, you sort of bridge that gap. It's sort of like if I had a house full of sons, I have a house full of daughters. I have three daughters, 36, 33, and 18. And just getting these stories, because I think I like storytellers who can help people reading them from avoiding the mistakes that your protagonists and other characters make in the story. Will hopefully make them think about, wait a minute, in this story, Maybe I shouldn't go on that car ride with the guy that wants to go still take back these records collection.
Yeah. I mean, I think, fiction can really connect you in ways that connect you to the issues in ways that nonfiction cannot in the same way. Here's an example. It's season four of The Wire about the kids, if you remember that one. You can read all the news stories you want about kids in the inner city and what all the problems they face and so on. I don't think you can be as impacted by those as watching season four of The Wire when you follow the lives of these boys, these four boys from, beginning of a school year to the end and what happens to them. It was a tremendously emotionally affecting through drama and fiction. You can say, for example, you take the old guy that she interviews in Knickerbocker, the Robert Charles character, and she doesn't really understand what his life was like. She just sees that he's an angry guy. But then when he starts talking about the way he grew up in Washington, that actually became segregated under Woodrow Wilson. Wilson segregated the government. There before that, federal you could be black and be get into the federal government as an employee and work your way up into management. And he stopped that. This guy went to war. He grew up in the alley homes, which are unique to Washington. There are houses in alleys, very poor, but it was a community. And he went to World War One. Like there was a lot of black soldiers who fought in World War One and fought admirably in France and so on. And he came back and to a segregated city. And of course he was angry, but he took advantage of things like the Carnegie Library was the only place in the city where blacks and whites could be together. And that's where he got his love of books. And because he could go there. And my mom told me this. She said she got her first library card there. It was desegregated, whereas other parts of the city were not. But there's a reason for his anger. Once you learn his story in the context of fiction, you understand a lot.
I remember a story I read by a Cuban American author, and it was a story about a family that immigrated to New Jersey, which was a little bit of history. I didn't know that a lot of Cubans actually immigrated to New Jersey, not just to Florida. And he told the story about the anger and the trauma of those families so well. From the Fidel Castro regime, that even though I believed in, open ties and open relationships with it, at simultaneously, I finally figured out, okay, I understand why they don't want it. I mean, abstractly, the why, but the story was told so well from an emotional perspective.
Right.
And once that emotion hit, you're like, I understand. I understand why they oppose it. I totally get it. Before I read that story, I'm just dealing on it from an intellectual level, which isn't the
That's right.
same as the power of the story.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
So talk about what motivated you to, going back to the very beginning, pulling this collection together. At what point in your mind did you say, I have some stories, I want to pull together an actual collection? And putting these stories together makes sense.
Well, we were on strike, the writer's strike. I couldn't write for television or the movies. I couldn't produce anything. And I wanted to write. I like to write every day, and I hadn't written a book in about 4 years, published a book. And I had these four stories I wanted to tell, and I knew that they probably wouldn't work as novels. So I got down to it. You know what I mean? I went to work every day for that year during the strike, and I had the time and the motivation to do some work, some prose work. That's what I did.
How important is it for aspiring writers to consistently work on developing your craft? And how do you know if your writing is getting better?
Well, I'm a firm believer in working every day, even when you're blocked, or you just don't want to work, which is the same thing to me. I just think you got to put something down on the screen or on paper, because you're going to rewrite it anyway. But one thing you can't rewrite is a blank page. So you might have some bad days, but you just go to work. You know what I mean? And that's just the way I've always done it. When I'm writing prose, I work 7 days a week. And because it's really hard to come back into that artistic tunnel if you've left it for the weekend. And I tend to write on two shifts a day, and I write new stuff in the morning and I rewrite at night so that I'm ready to go forward the next day. That's always worked for me. That's the way I've always done it.
So how do you fit in the living that you need to do to be able to write good stories? I was watching this interview of you on YouTube. You were at I believe it was a Greek college about 12 months ago that you had spoke at, and you were talking about, you know, to be a good writer, you need to read a lot and you actually need to live a life. And when I remember when they introduced you, they talked about all the different jobs that you had. So writing is not simply about navel gazing, but it's about living life.
Yeah, that was actually the Greek seminary, the Greek Orthodox seminary up in Boston. I went up there and spoke, which is pretty interesting. Yeah, I mean, look, you got to have something to write about, too. So I've also always advocated for getting out there and experiencing things and talking to people, and not just, you know, embedding yourself with the police or private investigators, but to walk into a neighborhood and talk to people, or even just, you know, riding the subway and listening is also valuable, or sitting in a bar and listening is also valuable. And that's where you get the voices, even the stuff that I do down at, you know, I wish I could tell you that I'm an altruist and things I do like down at the jail and all the prisons I go to and stuff like that. Yes, I'm doing something, you know, hopefully I'm doing something good, but on the other hand, I'm getting a lot out of it too, because I'm listening to these guys talk who are locked up, and I'm not only getting stories, but I'm listening to the poetry and the language and the different voices. And so everything's work for me. Is it's all about, you know, bringing things into you that you can then filter out.
Who are some of the writers that inspired you?
I guess I really like the, you know, these sort of proletariat writers like John Steinbeck and A.I. Bezerides and all that group, John Fante. I, you know, because they were writing about the things that I'm interested in, and I'm not comparing myself to Steinbeck, but that's what I've been trying to do my whole career, is illuminate the lives of people who don't normally get written about. And it just so happened in Washington, it was working class, you know, people on the other side of the city. That was most influential to me. And then I'll take somebody like, I haven't mentioned Edward P. Jones. I'm sure you've read him. He was a guy who, and he hasn't written a lot. He's not. I'm losing my words here, but he hasn't written a lot of books, but what he's written has been consistently excellent. And he grew up in the city. He went to Cardozo High School, public high school here in the middle of the city. And he's a phenomenal writer. I got to say, he's the best writer that's ever come out of Washington, D.C. And he was an influence.
So to lighten up as we get to the end, are you a sports fan?
Yeah, Washington teams mainly.
I was going to ask, you live in Maryland, so Ravens versus Commanders, who you got?
I live right on the district line. I'm a Washingtonian, so but I'm not one of those guys. No, we're not one of those Washingtonians that roots against the Ravens, okay? Because I, unless they're playing Washington, I root for the Ravens. I got, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Baltimore working, and I've made a lot of friends there. As far as basketball goes, the Wizards, yeah, but my other favorite team is the New York Knicks because I got to go back to my favorite squad of all time, which was.
I know that squad. DeBusschere,
Yes.
Bradley,
Yeah.
Willis Reed, Earl Monroe, Walt Frazier.
Yeah, exactly. The best starting five, in my opinion, in history.
I was an Earl Monroe fan before he got to the New York Knickerbockers, before he got to the
Wait,
Knicks. I
what?
was a fan when he was at what used to be called the Baltimore Bullets.
That's right. And I used to see him play back then, and I had, you know, I did a halftime show at a Wizards game where they were interviewing me, and they said, "Who's your favorite Wizard of all time?" And I said, "Earl Monroe," because I consider the Bullets and the Wizards to be the same team, right? That's
Right.
we got
Yeah,
them from
yeah.
Baltimore,
I
and a
keep
bunch of,
forgetting that. Yes, absolutely. I
so a
love
bunch
the
of
spin
people
moves.
corrected me. You know, they wrote the next day on Facebook that I didn't know what I was talking about. Yes, I do, man. Earl Monroe did play for the Washington for the Baltimore Bullets. He did play for them.
Oh yeah, no, I was a fan. So, were you ever a fan of Johnny Unitas, or were you a Sonny Jurgensen fan, or Billy
Both.
Kilmer fan?
That was a big deal here, Sonny or Billy. I liked them both. And then a big thrill for me, I used to play in the Greek Goya, which is Greek Orthodox Youth of America. I used to play in the basketball leagues growing up. And we won a tournament in Baltimore, and Johnny Unitas handed me the trophy. You know, good game, son, he said to me. And, you know, that's a huge for a teenage kid to have Johnny Unitas hand you a trophy. It's huge.
Wow. Oh, I remember Johnny U, John Mackey, Bubba Smith. I
Yeah,
remember
and
those
those
names.
guys, there was, I always talk about this with my sons, you know, when they're talking about the greatest of all time. Those guys took hits all game long with no penalties. It was a different game. You know what I mean? Way
Yeah.
different game.
And it's still my favorite quarterback of all time is actually Joe Montana. The way they run up the
Great.
yards today. I mean, if he had been that well protected, A, he would have lasted a lot.
That's right.
So, well, thank you. Thank you so much, George Pelicanos, author of Owning Up. I really enjoyed this short story collection. Always enjoy having you on the show. And hopefully, we'll see you sometime in the near future.
It's great. It's really great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.